Township then for introducing in a way the other side of the coin of what we heard before from Dieter and the section on labor markets, that there's an informal dimension to transport which in a way is ignored often by policy makers or statements about policy, and we might want to dig further beneath the surface of that fundamental issue. Siegfried and I will now chair together the discussion, but Dr. Pastricha, you had the first slot. And I would very much welcome if we could frame questions to the key speakers, which can then be answered and we can go in greater depth into some of the issues. You're on.
My questions are from Shavu. Now, how did you manage to widen the roads in the historically old and narrow areas? And what kind of opposition you encountered while removing the encroachments, especially the vendors and slums, etc.? What is the acceptability level? Is it forced upon them or was it nearly democratically done? That's one question. And second is, as a part of strategy, you are proposing to enhance the parking spaces. Would it not be counterproductive then that you'll be again encouraging the private cars mobility, which will ultimately reduce your mobility? So, I mean, how are you going to reconcile that kind of position?
Okay. It's the two questions. I would like to go to the first question. Actually, if we discuss here the mobility and the transportation, especially in the city like Shanghai, in fast developed fast of a transformation from a traditional society to an industry, or we say the modern society, then we can find the different aspect from the different people today. The first is the functional. The functional is very clearly we can see the presentation, the presentation by the Professor Liu there, very functional to see the transportation. And the second is the social aspect. We can see the especially very impressive lived a really very good aspect about the floating people here, also very especially in Shanghai. And the third, I think we mixture a lot of same terminology, but actually it's different meaning in developing country and in developed country, like a pedestrian area. Actually, the pedestrian area, the traditional pedestrian, and the rationalized, and the after the way disaster of the car development, we developed a new pedestrian area. It's the totally different. We can see the different things, and we can also see the transformation of the spirit and the people, the way to deal with the modern city. Actually, you mentioned the accident and the death in China. The most the dangerous is in the fast, especially in the periphery area. The people from the rural area transfer to a city life, then paid more life for the modern transporting system. It's not in the city itself. It's much more. So we can see the different the questions come together. I think it's very good. We should transfer to the Professor Liu. You can tell more as more maybe the question two there. If Professor Liu can answer this question two. And especially also the question one, the history, space, transport, the transportation, especially not only the transportation form, actually also the
how you could widen the roads. Was it only through the elevators, or you really conceived some other plans to do it? No, why I'm asking you this question is for the audience here. No, I'm giving an example like Mumbai city. It has a population as big as Shanghai, 18 million, but the total urban space is only 438 square kilometer. And the total road length is about 2100 kilometer. And in the inner part of the area, the population density is more than 100,000 per square kilometer. So that's why trying to, you know, and about 6.5 million people are staying in the slums. And there are about 450,000 are vendors along the footpaths. I just thought I'll just sensitize you. So I would like to be wiser. How did you encounter those kind of problems and were you able to overcome?
整个城市人口和机动性要求这样的关系，因为对上海这样的城市，现在就是4100万人次每天的需要，今后还可能到5000万6000万，在这种情况下，首先应该满足流量的需要，其次才是速度上的需要。 因此把比较大的投资集中在交通走廊、大运量的交通方式上，特别是地铁和快速的公共交通系统，应该是上海这样的大城市的首要任务。刚才说到人口密度，上海曾经是16万人每平方公里，就出现在我们附近。 这个时候，上海一天的乘客量是1500万，是当时世界上第一的，那是1981年。那么现在不可能承受这样的密度。现在的我们的范围一般是在2万到3万，可能已经是个极限了。那么在这样的情况下，只能靠公共交通和包括出租车在内的多种方式的公共交通的系统。 那么上海的高架道路，刚才提到了，是和欧洲不一样。但是我们的这个道路系统，只为现在60万辆的私人汽车都感到这么紧张。如果到600万辆汽车，那么上海内部的空间可能就更显得没有办法。所以在这种情况下，上海的道路系统是一个。 可以说世界上比较少见的系统，我们今后的几年还可能在640平方公里这样中心城范围里面建设相当数量的快速道路的系统，来保证一定的交通流量的需要，其中包括可能有1.5亿车公里一天这样的要求。现在我们已经到了9000万，已经是纽约大纽约州的一半。 好，我就接着这些情况。我有个问题，想对波哥达的情况了解多一点。刚才说到波哥达的公共快速公共汽车 BRT， 超过香港地铁的效率，一小时能够有4万乘客一个方向，我们很难理解。我们派人去数过，没有数出来，因为上海现在的地铁1号线一小时是4万客流。 我们是3分钟的间隔，6项编组，已经是很难承受，所以很想了解一下波哥达这样的一个效率。完了。
I thank you for that. I think it would be interesting to, in a way, pick up some of the key points that also Herman posed at the beginning of his introduction, which is going away from the statistics of the large scale and beginning to deal with the qualitative issue, and obviously Enrique picked up on that. And perhaps, Herman, you may want to, given what you've heard, in terms of the reality of large-scale, massive investment in the public transport infrastructure of the city, might want to comment a bit more on your thoughts on that. Herman, and then Enrique, on what you've just heard.
Investment into different kind of modes. I was totally missing the investment into pedestrians, which are the lifeblood of the city. You have already the cycles there, and I have a little bit missed the short relationship between roads and parking in relation to public transport and urban planning. And I have totally missed a little bit the relationship to urban planning, because as a practitioner in transportation, we don't have to accept each transport demand. If transport demand is growing up, we have to play back the ball to the urban planner. Because if transport demand is going up, this is an absolutely sure indicator that urban planning and urban logistics is poor. So if we don't accept each kind of transport demand, the urban planner has to go back to redesign and reshape the city, or at least the inner structure of the city, to compensate physical mobility by a little bit more mental mobility in planning and organizing. These are always totally close related factors. And if we compensate mental mobility or physical mobility by mental mobility, the city will sustain, because this is absolutely the direction where the future is going on, and the evolution have extincted everything which was not intelligent enough to cope with the limited resources we have. And concerning the, it is not so difficult to distinguish or find the right way, because the differences between the modes we are using today is about 10 power 2 in difference in using space and difference in using energy. The modes which is the mode which is most liked are the cars, but it use up and eats up the city and destroy the dimension, the human dimension of the city. What I have forgotten here is that what I have seen, you are not only having pedestrianized, or you don't have, you are not only having the wonderful Nanjing Road, but you have also the quarters. And I think this is one of the most pedestrianized city I ever have seen of this scale. And this is an asset for the future. You cannot find it in Hong Kong, you don't find it in any other city. I think this is a wonderful example. And when you are talking about Mumbai, these are not high-rise buildings where you are talking about this high density. And I think we have to distinguish carefully between high density, which means high ability of being able to, what we are talking all the time about, a high mixture of functions of close nearby living of poor and rich people to compensate a little bit the social tensions. It is, if the rich people know the poor and the poor know the rich, then the tension is going down, because the all the big tensions are coming up from distances. If the people are distanced from each other, then they don't know each other and don't respect each other. And we have to take take into account, we have been a little bit, since we are using so much energy during the last 100 years, we have forgotten a little bit our necessary scale also in architecture. Architecture has also lost the human scale in the urban context. And so everything is fitting together. I think this is contributing, this discussion is contributing to discussion in the morning also.
Enrique.
Thank you. Well, I wanted to refer to some of the, for example, Tony Travers mentioned that the London buses, even with the optimized systems, can only make 8 kilometers per hour or something like this, or six, I don't know, six. Well, Bogota buses do 26 kilometers per hour, including stops. The speed for a average speed for this system is very similar to that of a subway system. and the capacity now is moving more people per passenger hour than the London subway, for example. It basically achieves this because, I may have seen, we have two lanes in each direction. So most buses really are express buses. And a few stop at all stations, so people can really shift from the express to the local bus and make as many changes as they want. And I would very much like to, it would be an honor to have Professor Lu visit us in Bogota to show you how it is done to move these 40,000 passengers per hour. But I think that also I had a misunderstanding about the cost of the subway that they are building here in Shanghai. And I had 8 million, and it's really 80 million euros, so that means $100 million per kilometer. So if we are talking about 800 kilometers over the next 15 years, or whatever, 20 years, I don't think that in Colombia we would, even if we were to develop, to solve all the housing needs of the country, and to solve all the possible investment projects we have dreamt about that are in the books, we would not have enough projects to do with the $80 billion that would cost. So this is a matter of resources. So I think even in very advanced societies, such as Canada, in Toronto, for example, for the new expansion of their transport systems, they have adopted bus systems because it's much less costly and also is nice. I would not say you have to choose between one or the other. I just say it's complementary because you can have some trunk lines with heavy rail and then to have complemented this with some sort of bus system. In our case, we think we can solve all our problem with buses, but again, if we have a very heavy use line in the future, we can eventually substitute for one rail or something. But again, the question is the model, I think, the issue of being above the surface and how to use this space. To go back to Professor Knoflacher's issue, I'd say there are two approaches to a city. One is to how to make it more productive economically, even if people are not so happy. And the other way is how to think of the city, how do we make a city so that people are as happy as possible? And I think in the end, you will end up also making the city much more productive.
Okay, thank you. And we turn to the Professor Ida.
Thank you.
Do you have a phone here? Okay,
hello.
Please.
Hello? Yeah. Yeah. Thank you very much for providing me the opportunity of speaking. I'd like to mention something about the questions asked by several people and also by Professor Chen. It would be very important that when we would like to discuss what is the suitable transport system or what is the suitable transport policies are highly dependent on various things. Firstly, on the size of the city, what we should do for the Shanghai mega city is completely different from what we can do for the city with 1 million people. This is very important matter, firstly. Secondly, what we can do is also...
Can you say more about that?
Pardon me?
Say more, expand that difference.
I see.
What is
I
the
see.
Difference?
Difference.
1 million or
okay.
10 million.
For 1 million city, the size of the city is of course limited. So even if you or people want to use the bicycle as a major transport mode, it's possible. And I think it's my favorite. But for Tokyo, the bicycle cannot be the major transport means. Of course, it can be the complementary transport. And we are tackling to promote the use of bicycle. But it cannot be the major. So this is one thing. Mm-hmm. And the second is the solution must be also dependent on the history. We could invest the extensive railway system after the World War. But we are lucky, we were very lucky, because we could invest before the motorization. But you are now already in the midst of motorization, so our solution cannot be completely same as your solution. And thirdly, the solutions or measures has to be dependent on people's awareness. So if people like using bicycle can be. Or if people like using buses can be. But in generally speaking, in the developing countries, bicycles are not very favorable transport means, in fact, for the middle class or high class. So we should educate people, or we should provide information, or we should provide a views or a vision for the future. Finally, the disparity of the income is also a affecting factor for the suitable transport means. For example, in Tokyo, the income disparity is the smallest in the world. So we have no poor people. At the same time, we have no rich. So that means taxi drivers' salary or bus drivers' salary are almost same as me. So labor consuming transport is not very efficient for us. But for other cities, having the low income people, maybe the bus system can be the suitable. So just comment. Thank you very much.
Geeta, do you have some response to the comment or some comments to Professor Ida? Because it's a really very interesting conversation. It's a lot near.
I want to respond to that. The first question was about we have to consider the city size in deciding what transport system we want or what priorities we should have. I have looked at data of many large cities, and let me just quote data of the two cities that I know in depth. Mumbai, which Dr. Pasricha, as he mentioned earlier, 18 million people, highest per capita, it is the financial capital of India, and Delhi, which has the highest per capita income in India and highest car ownership in India. When both mega cities, when we look at the trip distribution, we find that not more than 15% of the trips are more than 15 kilometers in length, which means 85% trips are less than 15 kilometers in length. So what priority are we talking about? If you look at small cities, 1 million, 7 million, 9 million that Enrique mentioned, the distribution doesn't seem to change. Of course, the difference is that 15% of 18 million is a huge number. So then you are talking about maybe we need a high capacity system at that time. But that still doesn't change your priority. If you have a priority, you cannot have a city. If you want people to use rail system or bus system, they have to walk. In fact, eventually, 100% of the city residents are pedestrians. So in my mind, there is no doubt about priority of transport systems. And for bicycles, as far as you know, the difference between poor and rich countries are concerned, our understanding is that we are talking about, I don't want rich people, and I don't care whether rich people or middle class people use bicycles in these cities. There are enough captive users. And if we don't design for them, you have created suboptimal conditions for all. So that's the logic we must have for them.
Shami?
Quick comment and also a question. I think if the reduction of private car ownership is the solution to the problem rather than widening, building more roads, I think you're up against very strong constraints both from national policies favoring the auto industry. I mean, auto is one of the six pillar industries in Shanghai. And also you're up against growing consumer individual choices to buy cars and increasing affordability of the cars after China has joined WTO, reduce the car tariffs, and now car is increasingly affordable for a middle class person. So we're not talking about a small percentage of only rich people driving the cars. We're talking about growing consumer class who are looking at the cars, you know, as a higher standard of living and increasingly aspiring to be car owners. I think it'd be very difficult to overcome these constraints.
A society has the possibility, the right, and the obligation to restrict certain behaviors of people when it's in order for the public good to prevail over private interest. And it's not that we are talking about rich or not rich, but clearly all here in Shanghai, close to 10% of the people use car every day. Therefore, all investments that are made to make reduce traffic jams clearly are taking a huge amount of public funds in order to favor the richest 10% of the population. I don't know enough about China to know what the conditions are of the poorest 10 or 20 or 40 or 50% of the population, but clearly an investment, a public investment that is aimed to favor the richest 10% of the population is not very progressive. And also, I would not say that we should talk about restricting car ownership. People can have cars if they can keep them somewhere, no problem. We here are talking about rationalizing the use of a very scarce resource, which is road space, during peak hours. If people are going to use the car at 1 a.m. in the morning, nobody's going to do anything. But so in Europe, in the Netherlands, for example, or in any of these European cities where you have very little use of cars, people have cars, they own cars. They just don't use them at peak hours in order to go to work. So I think it's different. I think we are talking rather not of restricting car ownership, but rather of restricting car use during peak hours. And finally, about bicycle use, again, I don't think that the proposal is that everybody should go by bicycle, but that we should have I would say that if every citizen has the right to safe mobility, we should be able to guarantee that anybody who does not have access to a motor car should be able to have safe mobility in a bicycle, even if it's 10% or 20% or 30% or 50%. But this is all that I think as a society. I envy very much Shanghai. I think anybody who is an urban, I don't say an expert because I'm not an expert, but an urban enthusiast or an expert anywhere in the world believes that to have a city where it's safe to bicycle is a very desirable objective. And we envy Shanghai because Shanghai has a fantastic use of bicycles, and Shanghai has a lot of protected bicycle ways. And I wish my city would have and my country would have something similar to what Shanghai has.
Okay. Hema, please.
I think a city is also a social network. If the social network, the informal social network, don't work, the city can never live. This, I think, is the important thing. And if you cut off the social network from each other by capturing the people in a metal block box, then you destroy the social network, whether it is fast or whether it is slow. This is very important. So we can only form a social network if we can interact with the people on the same level, on the human scale, even if we don't like it, because drugs are going with us. And we are producing an artificial environment. And what we have not talked about is the quality of the artificial environment, because the city is an artificial environment, and it has to be has to become a better quality. Yes, this morning we have discussed about architectural and something and social quality. Quality don't appear by itself. We have an entropy also in the cultural life. We have an entropy also in quality. If we don't fight against entropy, which means put some force to increase the quality. And if you are able to, if you are very easy able to escape of a bad environment, you don't improve it. This is, I think, one of the basic problems we are facing today. Support the people with a fast transport system and make the city worse. Or force the people to stay in the city to make a high quality life, a high quality economy, a high quality social life. Okay. And without force, you cannot go up. When we step up here to coffee or whatever, we have to put in some force, and we need some energy, and we have to put much more energy in the very precious mental energy. And that cars is an ideal tool for optimizing individual needs. Okay. But the city is not the sum of individual need, it is much more. But if you put the car, people in the car, the sum of all is not more, it is less.
Because of the limits of time, we just a choice the people don't have response, to. Please. And the afterwards, we will go to the conclusion.
So I have two questions for Mr. Liu. One is, what is the Shanghai municipal policy towards bicycling? Is it trying to increase it or decrease it? And the second is, what is the Shanghai municipal policy towards commuting in cars from satellite towns to the central city rather than in some other way?
Just answer. Don't
有三个政策可以集中回答你两个问题，一个是公共交通优先，在各个方面、各个范围都争取这么做的，包括对自行车，还有就是区域差别，包括对自行车、对助动车以及小汽车。在交通紧张的地方，这些只是一个一般性的工具，在比较宽松条件的 郊区或者是边缘区，个体交通工具就可以比较放宽。再就是道路和车辆平衡的政策，各种车辆和各种等级的道路都有一个相互匹配的关系。啊。Okay,
Ricky, you have to make the conclusion. The question.
I think just to continue on that theme before I just try and make another point is, if I'm right, Jerry, but please correct me. One of the ambitions of the white paper is to reduce cycling by 25% over a period of time within the framework that Professor Liu has been talking about. I just thought I might conclude, and I'm looking at Tony Travers and perhaps Anthony Mayer in making a point which I think needs to possibly be made, which was provoked obviously by Hermann Knoflacker and Enrique's presentation, which is linking, going beyond transport as a policy or as a means of just moving people, but bringing it back to this core issue of quality and quality of life. And just share with you an issue, and that's why I'm looking to my London colleagues, which is, I think, at the heart, and interestingly at the heart of what has been referred to as one of the world cities with a highly evolved transport system in terms of its reach and its capacity. And that is the following one. It's a very, very simple one. The London subway underground system is probably one of the oldest. It was started nearly 120, 130 years ago. And there is an argument, despite what we heard from the London plan, that it's probably, even though a lot of money, billions of money from the private and public sector will be invested in it, there is an argument, which is it has a natural capacity. I like your term, Herman, of entropy. You know, there comes a point at which you can't do any more. Then the question becomes for a city like any of the cities we're talking about, what do you do to that system when it's reached its capacity? Do you build more of it and just, in a way, increase the problematic that that might raise? Or do you do something which, certainly at the moment in London, is being talked about, which is leave it as it is, accept that actually you can't do more with it, but do much more about actually redistributing movements and patterns of life? This links totally to what was being said, I think, in the sessions this morning about labor and what I think labor markets and actually even types of workspace and the activities that can happen there. Put bluntly, all the sort of maps that we've been seeing of the three or four cities that have been talked about, and it is fascinating to see the different cities have very, very similar problems but possibly different solutions. All the dots, all the local centers, whatever they may be, one of the arguments in London is that, well, maybe one should make the city center, and I'm provoking, decay a little bit. Just let it go. Just let Oxford Street go. And actually improve the centers which are more like the new satellite towns, which 30, 40 years ago were. And in that way, people, first of all, don't use the transport system as much. But more importantly, they use it the other way. I know this was a big issue, Carl, in New York. How do you just stop traffic, commuters just coming in at peak times? And I think many of these issues perhaps need to be unpacked when talking about transport infrastructure, rather than being a sort of stable linear system, which only works one way, to think of it actually as a sort of generator of a completely different way of actually using the cities. But Tony and Anthony, perhaps you just want to comment on it.
Yes, yes. Can you hear me? Yeah. I mean, I do think that the issue is precisely as Ricky has described it. In the London case, which is the most mature of the mature cities we're likely to consider in terms of public transport, there is a perception that the public transport system has arrived at carrying the most it could ever, ever carry. Indeed, if anything, it's probably over capacity. Interestingly, in London, the amount of travel is falling, and the amount of travel by car is falling quite sharply, unlike the rest of the United Kingdom, where car use is increasing. And interestingly, and this may only be in the British context, if policymakers continued not to invest in public transport and continued to put pressure on car use, almost certainly the impact would be to hollow out the city, to push people to the rural areas where there are no constraints on car use. Car use is growing very rapidly in Britain's in rural areas and will continue to do so. So in a sense, I think that the kind of policies that might be possible in cities which are still have, as it were, the choice of keeping the car at bay are probably not as easily pursued in those that have allowed the car in. And that is, I think, a big, big difference. And as I say, I think that without massive investment in public transport, no chance.
Okay, thank you. Antonio, Mayor.
Take 20 years, most places can't afford it. Politically in London, it's now impossible to build a new road, and all I invite anybody to do to learn of the perils of building new roads is go to Bangkok, a lesson for everybody in the world about how not to do urban transport planning. Undergrounds just cost ferocious amounts of money, even though they are, in the end, probably the most efficient ways to get from A to B. We are where we are. Let's knock out major investment. Politically, roads, no. Fixed transport, 20 years, which leaves us with two other options, which are both unpalatable in their own ways, but are possible. One is to make your existing transportation systems work harder. So on your road network, clearly more buses can carry more people, and it's relatively cheaper to do investment in buses and bus lanes and enforcement. On the fixed rail systems, I'm always surprised so few people think of this, but it's basically lower investment than a new fixed rail is better signalling to shove more trains through per hour, and where in England we're seriously off the pace is more double-decker trains, get more people on the trains into bigger stations. The third option, which is the easiest option of all, which I'm also surprised how few people ever think of and has not been raised at all, is we're taking as a presumption that everybody's got the right to travel as much as they wish in an unconstrained fashion. Why not use immediately pricing mechanisms? One in London, we're now making it very, very difficult for people like my dear wife to come in because I've got to pay her $12. That immediately puts people off travel and onto other modes. The other is relatively straightforward. Double your underground and rail ticket prices, you will also put off people from travelling. We could do that tomorrow. Your snag is it immediately makes a major contribution to inequality, because clearly poorer people will be hit further than real people. But what I would say in this debate is we've got to be altogether more imaginative than just to think that spending billions of dollars of public money on new transportation systems will be the answer. It will not be.
Okay, thank you, thank you. And we should, because the limited time, and we should close this debate and this session. And I would like to say thank you very much for all of you, especially for the two and the presentations, and also the comparative study by Herman. And please come back. Now we take a rest, and in 10 minutes we'll come back to the next debate.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.